that elements meditation that we've just been doing is really helpful in that way of not holding to me and mine too seriously. That whole gripping that we do. So this is a theme I would like to share with you tonight. And please feel free to ask questions by moments, or say, what are you talking about? Doesn't make sense, or something. You're really welcome. Because I don't always make sense to myself either. So in Pali, this word for renunciation, which could be said as surrender, letting go, is nekama. And this is one of the 10 paramis that the Buddha spoke of, one of the 10 qualities that we have in us that we can also cultivate through intention in more classical Buddhism. But that's also just part of being human, eh? The Buddha, he just said it like that, didn't he? But it's also part of being human that there are moments to surrender, to let go, to release. And it's funny because I was in South Africa a few years ago, and I was guiding a talk on renunciation, and the members of this meditation group were all in their 70s. And I think they thought that we were a bit cheeky because we were much younger than them. We were guiding this thing. And one day I decided to talk a bit about renunciation, and I was talking about giving up tea, relinquishing tea. And I just took it as an example that you could try to let go of drinking tea. Myself, who has a huge tea attachment, you know, I find it very difficult to give up tea. And they got very indignant, very indignant. And actually, we never saw them again. Because they were like, what do you mean? How can you give up tea? There's nothing wrong with tea. How could there ever be anything wrong with tea? And I thought, yeah, it's true. And being prone myself to some indignation by moments, I thought you could also give up indignation as a practice. But yeah, I think that they came from more Christian backgrounds, and that word renunciation felt tough for them. It felt like, so you had to go and lie on a plank with a wet blanket and, you know, suffer. That it's not necessarily something that you would choose to do. Whereas it can also be taken, and it is in the Buddhist teachings, more of a something you would want to do. To give up something for a bit, to see what it's like. To tend towards letting go. And I was reading recently also in a book by Ajahn Chah of how Ajahn Chah started many monasteries in Thailand of the rustic sort, a little bit like Ekuthuleni, our retreat place, but with monks in Thailand, with very rustic huts and people sweeping the pathways and barefoot and, you know, this kind of thing. And people would come and ordain and think that that was the big renunciation, that they'd given up the world and everything, and then would find themselves still attached to their bowl, because they were mendicants, you know. So they would receive food from people, but they could get very attached to their bowl or their robes or their hut or their walking path, you know. And Ajahn Chah would point at that it's not the world out there. It's in the mind that we get attached, that we can get greedy, that we can hold on tightly, that we can clutch at things and go, mine, my bowl, my path, my meditation cushion, you know. So I think he was very astute in helping monks to see that it was actually here that they needed to come back to see the attachment, the gripping here. And in classical Buddhism, it's said as the four clingings, the four things that we stick onto in general, a bit like glue. We stick onto sensual pleasures. That includes ice cream. To rites and rituals. So we can get very, often in spiritual practice actually this can happen, where there's a right way to do things, the ritual, the, you know. Or we can think that the way that we do the rites, the rituals, are the right way, and the way that those people do it is not, they're just not doing it right, you know. It can go on like this. We can start wars about it, actually. About rules we've made in our minds, just all alone, just one person. We can make rules about how things should be. Or we can make rules as a group and think that group hasn't got it. So that happens a lot, every day, all over. There's a lot of clinging to views and opinions, which is a bit the same as the rites and rituals. And that also can come on a big level, on an international diplomatic level, as much as just one-to-one, you know, in the day. Me being right over you being wrong. It's an ongoing one that we stick on here. And self-view, view of being quite convinced that I'm this kind of person or that kind of person, you know. And often people will say it to you, oh, you know, I'm quite a perfectionist, really. And it's not always, you know, that's their idea of it, and then they need to stick to their idea of their self-view. So it's almost like trying to catch up with your opinion of yourself that you've made. Whereas we're normally more fluid than that. You know, we're not just this kind of person. And then we do that same thing to others. So these are the classical ones in Buddhism, the four clingings that we tend to get stuck to. And that can be brought into the light to be let go of. This is where that process of letting go can really come in, of noticing how we relate to these four clingings, these four super glues, Velcros of everyday life. Like those balls, you know, that you throw, and you have a kind of bat with a bit of Velcro on it, and shtick. So, yeah. I'm finding it more and more vital, I would say, to feel this weave between what's inside and how I'm experiencing inside and the outer world, to help with this letting go of whatever's sticking, to be aware of how the outside is affecting me or how I'm relating to what I call outside myself, the other side of my skin, basically. Oxygen here, oxygen inside. Water, air, water. I know that's a little bit, it's a bit abstract, but tending towards this wider view of experience, this wider tuning in and feeling of experience, of not just being me here, alone, with the things that I grip to in a separate world, but to feel that weave, like a flimsy, like there's just a flimsy cobweb between. I've been surprised by this journey to Australia and how every idea I had about this journey has been different. All of my, you know, the way we do that, where we imagine before we do something. Mm-hmm. So it took quite some organisation for me to have 3 months to come to Australia and see my old friends and, you know, 3 months off. It's quite amazing. And so I had some ideas. And I have really old friends here that I haven't seen for years. And there's been lots of different things happening. You know, one friend's mother died, I couldn't stay there. Another one's in some sort of trouble. Another one lives in a tiny place. And, you know, and I've seen some of them, but it's been just been different. And so it's been a journey of constantly letting go of my ideas of how things should be, of how I had this preconceived set up wishes of this journey, and all the time it's been, aha, so that's another one that it's going to turn out different. And I never expected to be at the Metta Center. That's totally unpredictable. I had no idea I would be doing this.
Surprise.
Surprise, yeah. Yeah, so that's been the fun part, and the other parts I've had to roll and rumble with it, you know, and change the plans here and there and contact another one, and so I felt that, and I felt that tightening that happens when it's not going as you quite want it to go, and how my body mind can get a bit gripped, you know. And suddenly that's less fun, and I need to ungrip. So what is it that allows us to do that? Because you can't really force letting go. It's not something, that kind of slipping of the rope, you know? That undoing, that unravelling of the knots. It's not something that can be forced too much. Otherwise you create more knots, no? And get more entangled. It doesn't really work that way. So to let things dissolve, I'm sure it's very different for different people how we do that, how we go into, in a sense, surrender, where we just go, well, I surrender to not trying to bend the world to my desires, to not try to control the outcome, to not be trying to be the winner who's going to achieve this. Almost like we're driving a car and suddenly we realize we're holding too tight to the steering wheel and our knuckles are white. And we're cursing at that one who's trying to overtake on the wrong side or whatever, you know. And I think, you know, whether it's in meditation or outside of formal meditation, where we can still be meditating, that that letting go of me being the one who's going to create it all, going to make it all happen. And that can also be just having a sense of enough. This is good enough, you know? So we're not always running to get something better. Just this is good enough as it is. So we're not running from unsatisfactoriness. We're not running from what we don't like, pushing it away. We're not running from aversion to try and get things moulded in a way that suits us. And we're also not... It can also be moving out of a complacency. So it's almost like the other side of the other facet of it. The other side of the coin can be, well, is this enough? Is this good enough? You know? Or do I need to do more? Is this good enough for me? Am I satisfied as a human being on this planet doing this? I've had this recently, being up on the Gold Coast, and there's a lot of high-rises and people with big muscles walking along the beach like this, people with facelifts, and not a solar panel in sight. And I'm thinking, wow, here we are facing climate change, and I'm going, is this enough? Is this enough? And then coming back to myself, but what can I do? Because all these people on the beach, I can't tell them to change in any way. But I can change my own way, and I can say, well, I'm going to give up flying. I'm going to give up taking aeroplanes. And maybe only travel to places with trains or something. I'm going to start with that. And so it's almost, it's like giving up a view of, well, I can't do anything about it, you know. I'll just wait for them out there to sort it out, to sort the world out, to sort climate change out. So there's a different attitude to this, hey, from that always coming from not enough, I need more, to, well, here am I being complacent, is this good enough, you know, how is it? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Or am I confusing? So yeah, making an open door between body, mind and our environment. So we can attune, so we can tune in. So we can tune into a deep body awareness. So we can know through that tuning into the body as a barometer, we can know what's happening in our emotions, in our thoughts. Not necessarily to analyze, but to, with the body awareness, to feel into the effects of emotions or thoughts. So we can actually feel the texture inside the body of, for example, a very negative thought, a very hard thought. It's jagged inside, isn't it? It's like having a table with sharp edges or something. And from that tuned inness, we can know what's wholesome. Our own bodies with have their intelligence. They have a deep cell intelligence that we can tune into and be able to navigate these waters without being sharp-eyed. Sometimes with meditation we can become quite like the witness, you know, so we're looking at ourselves, we're observing ourselves. And if we don't have enough metta, we don't have enough kindness in the way we do that, it can be, you know, I'm out to get you, you know. Negativity or something like that. And it could be hard and judgmental and like we're trying to catch ourselves out, you know, and not a soft attitude. And then what there is that's dark in there, it's like a big troll, you know, And it just, because it doesn't like to be seen, it just goes back into its cave like this, and it goes to the back of the cave and stays in the dark. And we don't see it then. And it's like how to coax it out. Those parts of ourself that we might be embarrassed about because they're negative, they're not, you know, great qualities. And if they stay in the dark, they're denied. And then they continue to be there, and they're still an energy that's influencing us and influencing our actions, but they're in the dark. And it's not so helpful that to have these parts that are hidden to ourselves. So I'm not saying that, wow, we've got to have everything out there, you know, kind of attitude, because I don't think that helps either. But to not let the trolls stay in a cave too long, you know, where they can just fester and be trolls and grow long nails, you know. But to coax them out with a lot of kindness, those parts of ourselves. So I find that comes as well through deep body awareness, through really body grounding, which is the first foundation of mindfulness that the Buddha taught a lot about, this anchoring into the body that we carry all our lives as a grounding, but also as an awareness. Wherever we go, we've got this with us, haven't we? Throughout our whole lives, we're carrying our body. We are our body. We're feeding it. It's always there. It's always there as a check-in awareness. What's happening? Where are the trolls? And that. I notice in Australia they have these, like on the buses in London, they have these like opal cards, you know. Except on the buses in London, you don't need to touch off. But in Australia you do. Otherwise it keeps running the credit, you know, and you're in trouble. And I found this out to my detriment, where I ended up with minus something on the credit, you know. And I was thinking it's the same, you know, is to stay awake enough to touch in. Touch in with your opal card and touch out. And just to touch in with the body, you know. Touch in. See what's happening. Check in that with so much kindness. And this surrender, this letting go, it's not like it all just happens in one go and then that's it. It's a lifelong thing that we're going to be constantly doing. There's always something to be letting go of. There's always something to be relinquishing. Some point of view that's not helpful, some idea, some aspect that's very different from this movement, from pushing away, because I don't like it, so get away from me. It's very different, this dissolving, this loosening, this letting go. I had some health problems before I came over here, and I've always been quite flamboyant with my health, with how I eat. I've always been quite carefree, you know. I haven't been one of these foodies who's really, you know. And I've enjoyed that, and I've secretly been quite proud of it. And then with this health issue, I spoke to a very good herbalist, and she said, well, you need to be gluten-free. And this idea of myself being carefree just crashed, you know. And it's been really good, actually. I've realised that I can, when I need to, for my health, you know. It's a bit more hard work when you're out and about to find a sandwich that's gluten-free, so you end up just not eating sandwiches, actually. You don't end up not eating cakes. and it's okay, I'm still here, you know. It's not really a great big suffering. But I think mainly what made me laugh so much, the irony, was letting go of this little bit of conceit, this little bit of pride that I had in being someone who didn't need to be one of those food special people, you know. When you get somewhere, you say, look, I'm really sorry, but I can't eat what you've just cooked me for medical reasons, you know. I'm very sorry, but I never wanted to be that one, you know. I like to be the easygoing one, but that's a view, it's a self view, you know. So I had this image come to me of my attitude having before been, you know, these people who have these cars with no roof, you know. Convertibles, yeah. And then me flying with the hair back and the scarf, and there I was going along, you know, my convertible. And suddenly, yeah, bye-bye convertible, hey. I'm on something more sedate. Also, I lived in a monastery in England for a while. For a couple of years. And one of the senior nuns was like my spiritual friend that I would go to talk about, you know, whatever problems I was having. And she used to tease me because I'd get quite indignant about things. See the indignance from the tea ladies coming back. And she used to tease me in a very kind way, but she would tease me out of my indignance because I had a lot of ideas of how people should be and what should be happening in the monastery. And I was a lay person, and they were all the monks and the nuns, and they had their robes and everything. And a lot of rules, 127 rules, and these ones had 300 I don't know what rules. And, but I had more ideas of how things should be than what was actually happening. So she showed me that through teasing me, which was quite good, this rigidity in my own mind about how things should be happening. And I think that was a huge learning, to realise that what I was projecting was much more rigid than how actually the people there were practising with supple minds around what the rules of the place and just each person somehow living it in some sort of original way. So there's this gap, hey, like you see at the train station, hey, mind the gap, you know, between the platform and the train. There's this gap often in sitting meditation, when we sit to meditate, of how our meditation should be happening and what's actually happening. Because our idea of meditation is it should be making me serene and relaxed and a wonderful person. And often it's doing something else because we're human beings and there's all sorts of things going on. And so just to know, to be aware of those gaps and feeling what makes the should be come up. Sometimes I can feel it literally like here, like a brittleness here on the outside of my arms, when I feel that things aren't going with my ideas of how they should be. Almost like I'm a jar with an enamel fired bit on the outside, you know? So I get a brittle edge to me. It doesn't work. But I can feel it with some touching into to some body awareness, touching my opal card, my diamond heart card.
Thank you.
And also when we do get those moments of going really into deep, deep body meditation, when we're I was going to say down there, but we're not, hey, because we're inside our body, really grounded, to keep feeling what's still holding, and to keep questioning that. What is it that's holding on? And I think it's best not to to put words on that. It's quite good for each person to discover that for themselves. That what it is, even if we don't find a label for it, even if we just stay with a feeling sense. Like a certain sort of curiosity, like, you know, those insects that have those big curvy things like this, tiny little insects, but they have big curvy things that come out the front and they seem to walk along like this. You know? They're like they're in the dark, they're prodding their way around, very lightly. And curiosity I find very helpful as a quality. A type of awareness, because it's difficult to be negative when you're being curious. Have you ever tried to be curious and down at the same time? It doesn't really go, does it? So to be going into inquiry, what's happening? What's happening in here? What's happening now? Tuning in. With these, almost like our eyebrows are up, like this, our thing here with the, what would you call these?
Antennas.
But our antennas that are our eyebrows of curiosity, but that are going inside us to see how we're relating to this weave between the outer and the inner. And with some patient persistence as well. Always coming back to patience with our practice. That we're going to keep starting again and again and again. We're going to keep not minding the gap, hey, okay? Falling into the gap. And so we need a lot of patience with ourselves and a lot of persistence. So that type of patience that keeps coming back to start again, get back on the train. Tap back in with the opal card. That wholeheartedness as well. Even if that wholeheartedness in practice doesn't mean holding tighter and more determined to achieve something. Wholeheartedness can be wholeheartedly giving oneself to a lying down meditation, like Hui Hui. In that letting go of the struggle, that letting go of being the driver, gripping the wheel, and just allowing to float sometimes. Just allowing ourselves to let go and just float in those moments of deep body awareness. Things can undo themselves when we're not trying to do it all perfectly. Just allowing for those moments of give up the struggle for a bit. Because sometimes we can come to meditation with that attitude of, you know, like going to a serious job or something with our briefcase and, you know. And it does need some floating, as well. Some float time on the big old Lilo. And tasting emotions, tasting their textures, to feel into them so we're not engulfed by them. And often there's a bit of a paradox between, I suppose, what I'm saying of going deeper into meditation, of feeling the tension and releasing, and going further and going, what's still holding on and floating? But sometimes we need to know what's best in which moment. And for that we need some skillful means, which is mindfulness. We need some ingenuity, which is knowing what's good for me, what works for me. It could be a bench looking at a lake. It could be playing guitar and singing. It could be more meditation or a bit less. It's knowing for each one what works, and having a feedback system so that you so you're feeding back the information to know what's helpful for you. So those four of wholeheartedness, curiosity, patient persistence, and ingenuity are called the four paths to good meditation. And they can be very helpful, I find, just in helping us to have some friends, some tools for surrendering, for letting go, for this nikama. I think that probably that I've said quite a lot now. I'm tempted to tell you a story though. Yeah, I saw this film a while ago. It's called Timbuktu, and it's quite a heavy film. But the bit I'd like to tell you is the not heavy bit. And it's an African village that's been taken over by jihadis. And so there's young guys walking around with machine guns, and they basically stop people from singing and from, you know, they take their guitars away. They're asking the women to wear gloves, to serve at the market, and all sorts of stuff like that. And even the local imam doesn't agree with it, you know. And he's like, don't bring your guns into the mosque, you know. Come on, it's in here that you can work on your hearts. But there's this incredible scene where these young boys are playing football out in the desert on some hard ground. And they're playing football so completely wholeheartedly that when a goal goes in, the goalie does that thing, you know, that they do, guys, when they play football, you know, so emotional, so dramatic. And he just goes like this, and he's down on the ground with his head in his hands, you know. And the others are all jumping in each other's arms, and you know, the big football thing, you know, the big hugs and everything. And then they're running like this, like they do, like we just scored a goal, it's the best thing. They're totally wholehearted about it. And there's no football. Because the jihadis have taken the football away. So they had that ingenuity to know what was good for them. Was to keep playing anyway, and they had that wholeheartedness to play completely, playing football, but there's no football. And it's a really beautiful scene, that. It's really beautiful. And I thought that's a way to go about our life and practice, our spiritual practice. And so what if there's no football? Let it go. We're still going to play wholeheartedly. Does that, does this bring up any questions for you? Does anybody like to add something or share something this has stirred in you? Or is it a Friday night after a long week?
More of a reflection on the last point and like the story and the analogy, because I think when someone's developing renunciation, it's more like in that spirit of letting go, you're kind of giving your football away.
Yeah.
But there is that spirit of it's good enough, you know, I can still carry on. There's no mobile phone, there's no Wi-Fi at the retreat, there's no comfy cushions, there's no, you know, air conditioning, there's no heating. But you've got the breath, you've got this body, and you've got this ingenious way to make yourself comfortable. Just be content and happy with the breath, or whatever your object is, and being grateful. The surrounding provided by generous people and kind people. Maybe that's good enough.
And I think what you're really touching on as well is about right effort. You talk about you need to know whether you're pushing too hard or whether you're just being too lax about it. And as you say, that balance of finding right effort is really each to their own, and it changes depending on the circumstance.
Yeah, totally. Whether it's floating, time to float a bit, or time to tune in and tap in a bit more. Or to tune in a very surrendered way. Changes, not just on, you know, this week it was like that and, you know, next week it was like that. It's periods in life as well where practice can be very energetic, and others where it really is lying down is the best. So knowing that, like making the soup, you know, and you taste it and you go, what else does it need? What can I put to this? A bit more water, because I put too much salt.
It does require some level of maturity in the spiritual practice too, to have that confidence in oneself, to know how to understand where one is at that point in time and what's required.
Yeah. But maybe that's an intuitive sense as well to develop that sense of knowing what's right.
Yeah.
I have a quote actually that's to do with that. I do need the glasses. This is from Ajahn Chah. He's saying, the Buddha taught that with things that come about of their own, once you have done your work, you can leave results to nature, to the power of your accumulated karma. Yet your exertions or effort should not cease Whether the fruit of wisdom comes quickly or slowly, you cannot force it. Just as you cannot force the growth of a tree you have planted, the tree has its own pace. Your job is to dig a hole, water, and fertilize it, and protect it from insects. That much is your affair, a matter of faith. But the way the tree grows is up to the tree. Understand the difference between the plant's work and yours. Yeah, thank you. I was forgetting to put that in. So your sharing brought it back in.
Whereas I think so often in our practice, what we do is instead of just planting the seed, we kind of want to dig it out and say, are you growing yet?
Yeah. Shall I plant you somewhere else? Yeah. Can it go faster? That's where you need the patience, the patient persistence, hey?
I liked what you were saying earlier in terms of understanding how our own self-view changes all the time, and it's almost like we're catching up to be the person that we anticipate to be. Would you be able to share more about the view of others? So the views and the expectations that we have of other people. So for example, our children or our spouse or friends, parents, children, etc.
Well, I think it's much the same as we do with ourselves, of fixing to an idea of who we are. We do that with the people that we know. We do it all the time, from some experiences of them. We make a story that they're then like that. And I was noticing recently, coming off retreat, I'd been on quite a long retreat, 7 days, and how you get that malleable mind, you get that soft mind, and that there are less tracks in the mind of how people are. And so, and it went on for a few weeks, this soft malleability, almost like I was walking in unknown territory, like I'd gone to Antarctica or something, you know? In that I didn't have prescribed experiences informing me how to relate to the present situation. And I found that very rare in my experience. And that normally it's like, if somebody comes with this sort of attitude, I react like that because I know that that's not good, that that's whatever, you know? And so that actually happened, that I went into a situation of working with somebody who was very difficult, quite an aggressive person, and I normally would have gone into some sort of tense freeze and gone, this situation is not good for me. Mm. How can I, you know, I've got to work with this person for 3 weeks, and oh dear, you know. And because of this coming off retreat, it just ended up that I kept on just taking it day, minute by minute, and day by day, in a completely new way, instead of fixing that person as impossible to work with. And I know that especially we do that with people we know really well as well. Mm-hmm. Hey. With our parents, for example, I do that with my mum quite a bit. I'm convinced I know, you know, she's like that and like that and like that. Mm-hmm. And then just being present with that, with my own tension of it, being present, really present with her, it normally helps for her to not be like that, to not play out all those expectations, you know? Because we do it, as someone projects this on that person, then they behave like that. And that's the crazy bit. when you feel like you have to dance in this the light of this projection to that dance, because they put that music on, you know. It's so I found it very interesting recently that what informs my mind, you know, what informs, is it past experiences that are telling me that this is how I should relate to this situation, you know, and is that actually wisdom? Is that helpful to just be almost reacting from past experiences of, you know, when this person approaches me with this kind of way, then I... So I think it's an interesting area to look into, the awareness of that.
Yeah, and conditioning.
Yeah, and what things are helpful, you know? I mean, I learned it when I was a child, you know, if I touch this flame, it's going to burn. So that's a helpful type of conditioning, isn't it? It's a helpful type of tracks on the mind that could be a snowy Alaska. With just light bird prints. Or can I approach it again and go, ooh, doesn't really burn that much, come on. Does that speak to you? And I think children are constantly leaping about and changing even more, aren't they? They're doing the change fluidity thing so quick. And I have that because I'm an auntie, four times auntie, and so I don't live with my nephews and niece full time, but often I come and visit them, and my sister says to me, oh, he won't eat that, and I'm like, yeah, but that's 3 months ago, he's a kid, you know, it can change in 3 months. That, you know, 7 years of I don't eat mushrooms, and then suddenly one day, you eat mushrooms for the rest of your life. That's... So yeah, to explore that, those more softer states of mind, where there are not too big train tracks, you know, to be able to tune into them by moments and just go back to suppleness, to malleable, to drop back into it. The print in the snow. Do you have some more to share? It doesn't need to be clever, or it doesn't need to be a question even. It could just be something that's coming, sprung up like that, a word. And it doesn't need to be either. It can be quiet as well. I would like to say thank you very much to Metta Center for receiving me here. And thank you for your attention. It's always very, very different when there isn't a huge crowd. It's a bit more, we're all a bit more shy. So thank you so much for staying so present throughout this. And may we be well, may we be in peace. May we tap into deep body awareness and through this find some loosening, some untightening to freedom. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.